This is the Erasing Shame Podcast, Season 5, Diverse Perspectives Discussing What Matters.
This is the Erasing Shame Podcast for June 2021. It is Pride Month, and so we will be having a conversation about erasing shame in the midst of Pride Month and being Asian American. We're grateful for our co-hosts, Hannah Lee Sandoval and Leah Abraham, joining us again. And a special guest, Tim Aoyang, who is one of the band members of Tim Be Told. Thank you all for being here at the Erasing Shame table.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah, Leah, how have you been? Last month, I was in bed because of COVID-19 vaccine recovery. I had a second shot of Moderna, and it happened to fall right before our recording session. So I was in bed for 2 full days with a fever. Aww. But that's all it was. And I've been well, and I've taken a first trip outside of Orange County and visited my mom in the Washington, D.C. area.
It was your first trip since the pandemic?
That's right. Yeah, we wanted to be fully vaccinated, so my wife and my son got to take that trip together, and it was good. And surprisingly, they do cram the flights, so every seat was taken, even masks. But I don't know. I'm glad we're kind of starting to turn the corner about this whole pandemic. How about you? Are you vaccinated, Hannah?
Yeah. I am. I'm the only one in my household that is.
Oh, that's a whole nother conversation. Okay.
Yeah, it feels a lot better. But it's been heavier, I think, for me as a therapist, the past couple weeks and months, just walking through the aftermath of a lot of the anti-Asian violence and continuing to process a lot of trauma. Mm. So therapists out there, practice your self-care. I didn't, and I burned out.
Leah?
I am vaccinated, and it was great. It was the happiest day of my life, at least in a long time. I was so excited. I woke up super early, and I never wake up early. I was very excited to get vaccinated, and so I'm vaccinated, and I'm doing okay. Last episode, I know I talked about looking for some help, and I'm glad to say I finally found a therapist.
Yay! Great. Awesome.
It just feels so good to especially as a type 2, just to have a support system that I can just just empty myself without the expectation of also receiving. And so it's just, it feels like a huge, it's a sigh of relief, really. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Tim, thank you for joining us. How about you? Have you been vaccinated?
I have been vaccinated. That was something that was very important for my family, at least. My sister, she works for Kaiser. She actually, she's one of their health administrators, and she actually was very big on promoting the vaccine, getting people vaccinated, especially in minority communities. So, yeah, I got mine pretty much as soon as it opened up for kind of the normal adults. Normal's maybe not the right word, but just the, people with non pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. Vaccinated and kind of living life pretty normally now. So it's been good. It's been nice to, have dinner with people at a restaurant, albeit, you do have to wear a mask, when you're inside. Yeah. But, other than that, I feel like, life is starting to move forward a little bit. So that's been good.
Yes, very good. And I suppose the vaccine could take up a whole episode. I don't think we want to go there.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to put it behind us in a lot of ways. This is the month of June. It is Pride Month. And it is a month where we, America and maybe parts of the world, highlights and gives recognition and dignity to those who have a wide spectrum of sexual identity and lifestyles. And so wanted to get some of your thoughts on that. while it is Pride Month and there's a lot of celebration, there is also a dark side of shame, especially for many of us who are from an Asian or Asian American or even faith community background. And so, Tim, can I ask you first to share some of your thoughts as you enter this month and with all your history that you might share a bit of and how it's been meaningful to you?
Yeah. This has always been an interesting month for me. I think growing up in an Asian household, anything that had to do with, pride or any kind of like display of, or acknowledgement of, some sort of like sexual difference, I think was frowned upon. This is an interesting month for me even now, since I've come out. I came out 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, in 2017. And, prior to that point, I had been doing, Christian music for almost a decade. My band and I, we did pretty well. We're fairly well known. In 2017, I decided to come out publicly, just because my whole life, this was something that I had kept a secret. And especially as a musician in the Christian industry, this was definitely something that I did not want to share with the world, just for pure survival reasons. When you're making a living, as a musician that is also, based in kind of the Christian faith, it's very difficult to articulate and talk about issues that are maybe more gray, that kind of don't fit into the paradigm of the Christian world. So I certainly had this very curated image that I was putting forth, that I kind of had perfected and crafted over many years. At the risk of sounding, pompous, I think I was fairly well beloved by my audience and by even the people in the industry. And when I came out, the reason I made that decision, it wasn't so much even for myself. Now, part of it was for me to kind of find some coherence between my public and my private identity. But a lot of it was, over the years, doing the music that I was doing, I would get a lot of messages, particularly from queer youth, a lot of Asian American youth, who would share with me privately that they were in the closet, or that they were depressed or they were suicidal. They would come out to me, and, at the time I wasn't out publicly. So there was a part of me that didn't want my story to get out there. I didn't want to risk somebody sharing something about my own life, and then outing me and then potentially tanking my career. And so, these kids would share these stories with me, and I wouldn't be able to completely be honest with them. So I give them kind of a very pithy or kind of generic, like, it's okay, God loves you and you're going to be fine. And at a certain point, it just started to feel untenable and unsustainable. I felt like I was lying all the time. I wasn't bearing false witness. I was just omitting, the truth. And so it all came to a head in 2017, and I actually came out publicly on my birthday through a blog post. And then I also did an interview with Inheritance Magazine, which is an Asian American Christian magazine, and basically shared my whole story about, what it was like growing up gay in the Asian Christian American world. And at first it was fairly well received. I had a lot of people who were appreciative of me sharing my story, but there was a lot of backlash. I mean, I think beginning just first of all with my family, you know, I came out on my birthday, and then my parents immediately texted me and they were like, "What have you done?" You know, they knew, they had known since I was in college, but this was something that they didn't want the world to know. They were just like, "You need to keep this to yourself." And I think part of it was a safety issue. I think they were afraid that someone who was maybe not in their right mind might try to hurt me, or there would be some sort of verbal or physical violence against me. And, you know, I understand that. I think as a parent, you want to protect your children, even when they're grown. You don't want them to experience pain or sadness. But I think that was one of the first hurdles that I had to get over immediately, was just kind of explain to my parents why I did what I did, and have them also have to deal with that fallout, because they go to a huge Chinese American church on the East Coast in New Jersey. And they started, the news got out very quickly. And so they started getting a lot of questions at church from, you know, all these like aunties and uncles and like elders and pastors that all knew who I was. There were a lot of, you know, youth at the church that listened to my music. So it was a really hard thing for my parents to have to navigate as well. And I would say that maybe it was even harder for them than it was for me, because their culture and their paradigm had no room for this. People had no way to, they had no language for this. And so I think for my parents, you know, as much as they might have stumbled through it, I also am very grateful that they, that they were able to talk about this issue with at least a degree of nuance, and they defended me to a certain degree. And, you know, that wasn't the only, there was obviously backlash in my career. I mean, that was expected. I knew the touring dried up. A lot of the shows that had invited us to perform canceled on us. And also, you know, right before I came out, my guitarist actually left. And that was actually one of the catalysts for me to finally come out, because one of the things that I didn't want to do was come out and then potentially ruin the livelihoods of these guys in my band who were dependent on me for a living. And so he was the last person to kind of leave. And that's when I felt like I could kind of take a wrecking ball to my career, so to speak. My career quickly ended at that point, as it had been up until that point. And then I think the biggest thing that I did not expect was how much that this would impact my personal life. The career impact definitely was expected, but in my church, I was actually leading worship at a fairly small Japanese American church in the California East Bay. And I had moved to California for this church. This was a church of, you know, really amazing people. When I was in touring California, they were incredibly kind to me and just welcomed me with open arms. They knew that I was gay. Up until that point, you know, I had also been single. I'd been celibate my whole life. I'd kind of abided by the church doctrines that I had grown up with. After I came out, the denomination told my pastor that they needed to remove me from any type of leadership position in the church. It was really confusing for me because up until that point, like I had mentioned, I'd been celibate. You know, I hadn't done anything that violated any of the church's policies or any of their bylaws. So it was really strange to me that they were telling me that I couldn't be a leader in the church anymore. And it was a really weird moment. The way that my pastor broke the news to me was him and his wife, we were at a Burger King, of all places. And, when they told me, it kind of threw me because it was so unexpected. And then like, it took me a minute to process. And then I just burst into tears in the middle of a Burger King. And so people were like walking by, like, why is this guy crying in a Burger King? And I think that there was just this flood of emotion. You know, I think when you're growing up as a gay person in a very religious environment, you always have this fear that people will reject you when they find out the real you or find out what you're really about. And that basically happened. And so that fear, you know, a lot of times, you know, we tell people like, oh, don't be afraid. Don't be anxious. Like your fears are probably overblown. Right. But for me, this was my fear literally manifesting itself right in front of my eyes. And essentially the denomination told the pastor that I could not be in any type of visible leadership. The irony was that at the time I was also, helping to renovate the children's room, at our church. I had redesigned it. And the denomination said, oh, he can continue doing that. They were fine with, in some ways, exploiting my skills and my gifts, as long as I wasn't seen or heard. And that message was pretty clear at that point. But the thing was, in that moment, I just told my pastor, I was like, don't fight this, because I just don't want you to get in trouble. You know, I don't want you to, I don't want you to stick your neck out for me. I'm fine with this. I can handle this. But he continued to fight for me, actually. He continued to ask the denomination, you know, why are you doing this? He hasn't done anything wrong. You know, I mean, he hasn't violated any of your laws. If I had been dating, I think it would have been a different story. You know, I'm okay with the church saying like, you know, actually we believe, if they're like, we believe this is a sin, and if you're not, you know, abiding by our particular, you know, rules for leadership and you can't lead, I'm okay with that. I have no issue with that. But the problem was, I wasn't doing any of that. You know, I was literally doing what I was supposed to be doing. All that had changed was that I just shared my story. And so he continued to fight for me. And then they eventually fired the pastor. It wasn't just because he was defending me. I think that there were some other issues going on between him and the denomination. But ultimately, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. And they fired him. And then shortly after, I think they brought in a new pastor to kind of, make things better at the church. Apparently, the denomination saw our church as kind of like this delinquent congregation. They brought in a pastor, and, you know, he happened to be white, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with white pastors, but this is, like I mentioned before, it was a Japanese-American church. So there were a lot of cultural things that he just wasn't aware of. And so immediately as he came into the church, he wanted to change a lot of the things that that were so integral to the culture of that church. And, you know, I hate this term, but it felt like there was a whitewashing that was happening to the church, that he was trying to change the culture of the church so that it was a little bit less Japanese or a little bit less Asian, and especially through the architecture. So the building itself, it was like, I think it was built either like, I think it was like right after the war, after Japanese internment. And even a lot of the elders that, the elderly people that were in the church had actually lived through internment. So this church has been around for almost 100 years, at this point. And, you know, there's a lot of Japanese architectural elements. There were like, there's like a small Japanese garden. And so, you know, this was not just a place of worship for the Japanese American community. This was also a place of like refuge, like a place where they could, you know, like a community center as well, right? Where they could feel safe in a way, you know, especially after kind of the terrible things that happened to the Japanese people, or the Japanese Americans during World War II. And so this pastor came in and started kind of changing things up, you know, just saying like, I want to remove this architectural element. I want to get rid of this, you know, I want to change like the way we do our services and just the culture of it. It just felt like, it started to feel like he was trying to transform it into this like cookie cutter evangelical church. And it wasn't that. Eventually, and there were a lot of things that ended up happening, but eventually there was so much conflict between the congregation and this new pastor, that, and we found out eventually that there were some there, we heard rumors of abuses that he had committed at his previous church. And so it eventually came to a head and he got the denomination to shut down our church, to basically kill this church, you know, that's been around for 100 years so that he could start over again. And basically in order, he wanted basically everyone to be kicked out, so to speak. And then once they started back up again, if you wanted to be part of that church, you would have to basically sign some sort of agreement saying that you were in line with the denominations, you know, doctrines, theologies also, and his, and kind of his ideological framework for how a church should be. And that was pretty much one of the most devastating things that came out of all of this, was that it wasn't just my life that got affected. It was that this church that has served as a place of worship, a place of spiritual and cultural refuge was just obliterated. And I struggled so much with the guilt of that afterwards. And I think cognitively I knew that it wasn't my fault, but in my heart, you know, growing up in a church environment where I was always feeling guilt for who I was, this was just one more element of guilt that I took on. And it was hard not to see that my coming out had triggered a series of events that led to this point. You know, I recognize that I wasn't responsible for it, but I was certainly the catalyst for it. And that was a hard thing for me to bear. And I just kind of disappeared off the face of the planet after that. I stopped doing music for a couple years, at least as an artist. You know, I wrote songs for people behind the scenes. And I just kind of got off of social media and just stopped talking about myself in general, in any type of public forum, just because it was so painful, what was happening in my personal life. And, you know, about a year into my so-called sabbatical, I started writing music again, and started writing the songs for my latest album, Love and Happiness. And there's something very powerful and potent, when an artist has nothing left to lose. There really is this kind of like ability to say whatever you want. And that's what I did. And I wrote songs about being gay, and what that was like, and growing up in a Christian environment, you know, having to contend with all of that. And I didn't veil the struggle in like metaphors or analogies or, you know, like illustrative language. I was just like, I just was very literal about it. I just was like, I talked about falling in love with a guy that didn't love me back. Just everything, you know, and this was definitely not something that would fit into, you know, the Christian you know, paradigm that I'd been part of for a decade. But it was one of the most honest pieces of work that I've ever done. And so I ended up releasing that, weirdly enough, in 2020, in late spring of 2020, you know, right in the middle of the pandemic, right at the start of the racial justice movement. So there was a lot of stuff happening, and a lot of people were struggling. And I just thought that my album would just get lost in the noise, because there was just so many things that people were talking about, and why would anybody care about me releasing music? But one of the coolest things was that right before the pandemic, this was literally days before the pandemic, it was the end of February, before the pandemic hit America, and I did a listening party for my album in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it was amazing to me because I hadn't performed in so long, but 200 people from the Bay Area ended up showing up to this event, and they listened with me through my entire album, and I was up there kind of telling the story of all the different songs. And I kid you not, like at the end of that event, I would say like 90% of the room was like weeping or crying or tearing up. It was really an incredible experience, and kind of this clash of different worlds, because there were a lot of conservative, you know, Christians there, but there were also a lot of queer people that had, you know, experienced trauma at the hands of the church. And so there was this very cathartic moment where these worlds were kind of coming together, and they were interacting with each other, you know, people talking to one another about, you know, the pain that they had gone through, and you know, people from the kind of the conservative side of things, you know, hearing these stories for the first time. And it was really quite a beautiful moment. And then March happened, and then we were all in lockdown. And so, you know, I debated, you know, whether or not I was going to release the album, and I decided ultimately that I was going to. And so after I released it, it was just really kind of crazy. I got a really powerful response from people, a lot of queer youth and even adults, you know, that just expressed to me how meaningful the album was. A lot of Asian American Christians, you know, whether they're gay or not, said they found they felt like I was articulating the feelings of imprisonment and like the inability to express themselves fully, and they were able to kind of feel like the music was articulating their emotions and their thoughts for them, and so that was really cool. And so, you know, since the album's been out, you know, my whole life is kind of has transformed in a way. I'm certainly more honest about, you know, every aspect of my life. I think that there's definitely more coherence between my public life and my private life. And you know, the album was called Love and Happiness, and you know, it's nice that I actually feel pretty happy now. Like I'm probably the happiest I've ever been in a long, you know, in a very long time. So, yeah, that's kind of my story. I know I've been talking a really long time, so you probably need like a commercial break in the middle of that. But yeah, that's kind of the story in a gist.
Well, thank you for feeling safe enough and healthy enough to share that with us. There's many directions we can go with this, but first of all, I want to say thank you, and I'm glad you're in a much better place. May I ask Hannah to give us a little context about just how hard of a struggle this is when it comes to Asian American identity, and how that takes such a toll and trauma for young adults that are dealing with that kind of shame and don't feel safe talking about it.
Yeah, I can't speak for anyone, but I have, you know, students and mentees and former Bible study students. And, you know, a lot of what I'm hearing is You know, there's this idea of intersectionality that we've kind of, you know, touched upon in previous recordings. But, you know, even without that idea, like being a teenager is so hard. Being a young person is so hard, especially with social media and being hyper-connected and all the cultural things happening. But when you have layers of being a person of color, when you're questioning or very sure that you have a identity or orientation or expression that's not like, you know, what you've been raised to believe is normal. And then you add on another layer of faith tradition or cultural dynamics, whether in family, church, or community, or even schools, where it, it's stigmatized just to be who you are. There is such, I think, heaviness and hopelessness that a lot of young people feel. And then, you know, the previous year has just been chaos and darkness for a lot of young people. I mean, older people too. But I think the difference with younger people is that they don't have a lot of life experience where they know I'll get through this. So, you know, I tell a lot of adults who are working or wanting to work with queer youth, you know, we don't know what their experience is like. And a lot of times what they need is just a safe place to kind of lay everything down and to be like, this is hard. I don't have any hope left. And I just need someone to hear me and care. And for that to be okay, you know, and for us to be able to say, I don't have all the answers, but I love you and I care for you. And we'll do this together a day at a time. During the pandemic and then during the heightened racial violence against Asian Americans, you know, the number one cause of death now for Asian American Pacific Islander 15 to 20 something, I think 24. So youth and young adults is now suicide. I think it was like in the top three or four before, but in the past year, it's like officially ranked as suicide. That's so heavy for me because when I was a junior high school counselor, I had to do a lot of the suicide assessments for my students and call on parents and administrators. And then later when we started the GSA or the Gay Straight Alliance together at the high school, which, you know, I shared on my Facebook today, actually, but it was like almost all church going youth, which I was so thrilled by. We're in Koreatown, but like half Latino, half Korean, you know, a lot of mix in there. But most of the kids that I did a suicide assessment for were part of the GSA, right? So there was such a link there, and I was like, this is something we can't ignore, you know? And they were able to ask hard questions and share hard things in our anonymous Q&A space that were just incredible. But, you know, I think people don't realize, like, most of the kids who identify as queer or even are not queer, but people think they are, or they're just questioning, they get bullied at school, they don't feel safe at school. So then you have this dynamic where these kids have nowhere to run, right? They don't feel safe at home. They're not out to their parents. They have a persona they've built. And then they have to code switch and be someone else, even then at church. And then they come to school. And if they haven't found at least one friend or adult that they can be honest with about what they're thinking and feeling, then there's nowhere to turn to. So if we look at some of those, you know, intersectional realities and struggles, it's not surprising that a lot of young people are struggling to find hope. But that's where, you know, I've been able to share various music videos and just like media, right, and culture. And Tim, your music's been a big thing that I've been sharing with my young people in my life. And they find hope because they're like, I'm not alone in my pain, you know, and they feel so heard and known. And just knowing like, you know, if one person before me has gone through this, maybe I can too. That was such a huge piece. But I think fighting shame and stigma is a huge, huge thing. We need to address that in AAPI communities, in families, definitely in the church. I don't know where we start except by sharing story and realizing, you know, just because people are different from us and we don't understand their experience intimately doesn't mean that we can't listen, right? And just honor their story and love them and care for them. So,
yeah. It's interesting that you talk about, even before we started recording, you know, you guys had asked me like what I define shame as. And I was like thinking about that cause like, and this is something that I've been thinking about for a while, but I think for me, shame is anything that, creates this or compels you to, be less of who you are. Mm-hmm. And I mean that, you know, that's a pretty reductive and simplified definition of it. But you know, kind of what I was talking about before is that when you have, and something that's very important to me, you know, as someone who, you know, has been a public figure for so many years, is that coherence that I was talking about, coherence between your public life and your private life is so important. You know, this is why famous people aren't happy. You know what I'm saying? Like people who have these very curated images that they put out on social media. Again, there's this kind of incoherence between what they present and what they're really feeling inside. So that's why you end up having people who are depressed or suicidal. And there's rampant drug use and drinking and whatever vice you could think of, right? And these things lead to more shame, right? More thinking like I'm just like this kind of terrible person that, you know, can't get my life together. And so for me, one of the biggest things that was healing, I think, for both my soul, my mental health, was figuring out how to bridge that gap between what I was presenting and what I was really feeling inside. And those things, it's never perfect, right? Like no one's ever fully, completely themselves in a public setting, right? Like we all censor ourselves to a certain degree, right? And I think that, you know, our social fabric in a way requires some of that, right? Like, I mean, you don't want to be brutally honest about everything that comes to your mind, right? I mean, that we would all devolve into chaos if that were the case as well. Although we're pretty close with Twitter, I think. but I think, you know, finding more consistency, you know, in my life and trying to make all parts of myself, whether public or private, as consistent as possible, has been one of the biggest things that has helped me achieve, I guess, happiness, if you want to call it that, but more peace, if anything. I don't feel the same anxiety because one of the things that I think is so difficult for queer kids, right? Is to find the courage to even just articulate that thing that you're feeling, right? Like to put words to it and to say it, because once you say it, it feels very real. You know, if it's still kind of brewing in the background, if it's still kind of hidden inside of you, then you can kind of just like ignore it or kind of, you know, put it in the back of your mind and kind of like move on. But the thing is, like, as that thing is like sitting there, it grows into like a monster, right? And you know, things that don't get sunlight eventually start to rot. And a lot of the queer youth that I've talked to, and even some of the adults that I've talked to, you know, that are still in the closet, you can see how that element in their life has started to eat away at their spirit, you know, at their life force, at their energy. And over time, there's like a resentment that starts to build up, you know, and you see this a lot, I think, with queer people in the church. You know, as they get older, there's this kind of like, and I've noticed this with a lot of adults. I've talked to a lot of elderly gay people who grew up in the church who are still not out yet. And it is so sad to talk to them because they feel completely isolated. They feel just alienated from the world around them because, you know, for so much of their lives, they thought they were doing the right thing by, you know, staying quiet and just doing what they were supposed to do in the church. And then, you know, you can be surrounded by people, you know, like, you know, friends, so to speak, right? You know, that you hang out with, that, you know, see you all the time. But if you're not yourself with them, mm-hmm. they might as well not be there. You know, if anything, it probably just makes you feel more lonely because it makes you realize that nobody really knows you. And I think I know a lot of people who are queer who on the surface, they look like they have a lot of friends, right? But then when you talk to them, they're like, I have nobody. There's nobody that I can talk to. I feel completely isolated. So anyway, that's just something that came to mind.
Thank you. Tim, I'm curious to hear more about your experience about coming out, but also navigating the intersectionality of all your worlds, right? Not only your gender identity, like your faith identity, but also as Asian American, right? Like Asian American itself is an intersection that mm-hmm. so many of us have to figure out what that means to navigate. And that's right. Like all of that. I'm curious what your experience of navigating all those intersecting worlds was like for you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I grew up thinking, so there's this kind of narrative right now in the world where it's just like, where like white is normative, but I actually didn't grow up that way. It's weird. I actually grew up thinking that Asian people were normal, like that what we did was normal, and that everything else that any other culture did was just strange to me. Like, I mean, one of the biggest things was like taking your shoes off in the house, right? So I would, you know, I mean, I grew up with a lot of, you know, Asian kids and Asian families. And so when you go into a house, like you obviously take your shoes off because tracking in dirt and dog poop from the outside is disgusting. But then, you know, I would go over to, you know, like a white friend's house or somebody, you know, who is not Asian American. And then, you know, they would just be wearing their shoes into the house and tracking dirt everywhere. And I just thought, that's disgusting. Like, I was just like, that's so weird. Like, why are these people so weird? You know, even the foods that I grew up eating, I thought those were normal, you know, and then I would eat, you know, and then, you know, I would try cuisine that was like not, you know, Asian American. I'd be like, this is not as good, you know? So it was just, I think like, this is my thought, like, we all, you know, when you're a kid, right, and you're growing up, like you just, you know what you know, and you don't know what you don't know, right? And so you just, for however I grew up as an Asian American, I thought this is normal, right? Like this, whatever I'm dealing with, this is just part of my life. And so without any kind of point of comparison, I wasn't really thinking about like being a minority, I guess, in a way. Like I wasn't really thinking about like, how does this set me apart, or how does this, make my life, like, how does this add more oppression to my life? I mean, I think as a kid, you really don't think like that in general. This is, I mean, we don't really develop language for this until like, you know, when we're a little bit older and we can kind of like, you know, hold some more complex and nuanced thoughts in our head. But, you know, I think even growing up as gay, you know, I never thought to myself like, oh, my life is harder because of this. It was more of just like, well, something feels weird, you know, because like all of my friends are, you know, like a lot of my guy friends were starting to like girls. And I was just like, I don't really like girls. Like I find them fun to hang out with, you know, and, you know, talk to, but, I quite frankly, like the idea of kissing a girl is repulsive to me, you know? So I would say that, you know, from a very young age, I was probably incredibly self-aware, of like, that, you know, that I was feeling different things. But, you know, as I've gotten older, even like thinking about like the intersection of, you know, a lot of people will be like, wow, you're kind of like this super minority, right? Like you're gay and you're Asian American, but then you grew up in the church. And like, those are certainly like, useful identifiers, but I don't see them as like my identity in any meaningful sense. I'll put it this way. Like being like, for example, like being gay, right? Like it's certainly affected my life for sure. You know, it affects how I relate to people, how I interface with the world. You know, it's affected my family life. But it's not necessarily what makes me me, right? Like it is a part of me, but it's not the whole of me. And I think the struggle that I've had, I think more recently, has been almost being like reduced to kind of these identifiers, right? Like, oh, you're Asian American, so you must feel a certain way about the stuff that's happening right now, or you're gay, so you should have a particular political ideology or whatever. So there's a lot of assumptions about like how I feel about things. And I'm just like, well, I don't always feel these things that people are expecting me to feel, you know? And so, again, I think trying to, again, it's about coherence, right? And it's about kind of trying to find consistency between my public life and my private life. Because I think oftentimes, for those of us especially who have been traumatized, you know, by church or maybe more conservative upbringings, right? It's very easy to just kind of throw out all of that and then just embrace the other side, right? Like just throw yourself into maybe more like progressive or liberal ideologies and just like and just immerse yourself in that, right? But there's something in that too that kind of erases your individuality. It erases like your story and your narrative because suddenly you're shifting and changing your story through the lens of a particular ideology. And so what I've done is like for my life is just like, I don't want to exchange one religion, so to speak, for another religion. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think every ideology has its kind of rules and kind of, you know, things that you're supposed to abide by, right? Like social protocols that you're supposed to abide by, like things that you're allowed to say, things that you're not allowed to say. Mm-hmm. And I've found myself to be a little bit tired of that because I've done that my whole life. You know, I've basically censored the things that I feel. And I vowed after I came out, I was like, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to bend my will and bend my thoughts and my feelings to suit someone else's ideology or suit someone else's opinions about what my life should be. Because I think that's the root of all unhappiness. I think that's the root of why people feel resentment and bitterness. It's this, again, it's this incoherence of what they feel in their heart and what is being presented. So really, I would say that I'm not even sure if I really answered your question. But in terms of like, in terms of how my culture and my ethnicity interacted with my being gay, it was certainly incredibly complex. Because in one sense, like I was a minority, right? Like I was an Asian American, you know, living in America. You're a very small part of the population. And so you're constantly othered. So there was definitely that. And then living in an Asian American household, being gay, that was also Christian, there was like both the cultural and the religious baggage where I could not share about any of what I was feeling at all. And then in church, same thing. Like I grew up in a very conservative Chinese American church. And I remember the Sunday school teacher once said that one of the kids asked, you know, how does God feel about homosexuals? And then the Sunday school teacher said, oh, homosexuals are all, they're all, Satan has a grip on their heart and they're all possessed by demons, basically. And so that was my kind of understanding of myself for so long. You know, as a young person, when you hear something like that, right, that like the devil has his grip on you, you internalize that and you believe it. And so for most of my kind of Christian upbringing, I was trying to constantly exorcise myself, like trying to pray away the demons, because for as long as I was feeling gay, like this must have, that means like something's wrong with me. So I was wrestling with the religious baggage, the cultural baggage, and I couldn't talk to my parents about it. I couldn't talk to any of my friends about it. So there was this incredible amount of pressure coming in from all fronts, right? Where it was just like, you can't share your feelings. But I will say that the one good thing that came out of that was it forced me to write music. And so it's really bittersweet in a way, because I think had I not been dealing with all of this kind of conflict and confusion and, you know, all these like different voices like that I felt like were shouting at me, it wouldn't have kind of forced me to find a way to articulate those things and express those things. And that's when I found songwriting. And so I started writing songs about what I was feeling. And it was so cathartic. I mean, I imagine that's what therapy feels like. I've never really done therapy officially. Like I've had some friends kind of, you know, help me with certain things. But I've never like sat down with a therapist before and paid them to like, you know, help me, you know, self-actualize. But songwriting helped me with that. It helped me put words and music to everything that I was feeling inside. And every time I wrote a song, like, just like tears would be just coming down my face. It was like this kind of physiological reaction that I couldn't control. It was like through that process of songwriting, it wasn't just like emotions that were kind of like releasing, but it was like kind of physical, like stress and trauma that was kind of like just like kind of like coming out of my eyes in a way. At the end of, and it still happens to me to this day, at the end of every songwriting session, I'm like a snotty mess. Like there's just like so much emotion there that like just needs to come out. And so I would say that it kept me sane, throughout like the last 36 some odd years of my life. I've been alive for 36 years. I've only been songwriting for like 20 of them, but it's definitely been the such a helpful way for me to communicate my feelings. And I think that's why so many people connected to the music, you know, especially a lot of queer people, that even though I wasn't writing about being queer for a very long period of time, there were people who could understand those emotions of feeling conflicted, of feeling like they live in two worlds, of feeling like that God might not love them, the feeling of like they have to sacrifice something of themselves for, you know, to follow Jesus, right? So I would say that my life has certainly been, has had very difficult moments. But then looking back, I'm just like, if those things hadn't happened, I also wouldn't be where I am today. And I wouldn't have been able to write the music that I'm able to write today. And so, you know, people ask me like, are you still angry at the denomination or the church that did this to you and did this, you know, to your congregation and to your community? And I can honestly say that I actually forgive them. Like I don't feel anger. Like I, in a way, it was like once I wrote the songs about it, it was like I just let it go. And in a way, like I almost can understand and have empathy for why they did what they did. I think that this was an issue that they weren't ready to talk about, and the only thing that they knew how to do was to hide it. And I understand that leading a church or leading anything is a very difficult job. You know, like there's so many people that are looking to you, and that you're under kind of a microscope, and people, and it's easy to criticize people in leadership positions. And so in a way, I've come to this place where I'm like, I get it. I know why you did what you did, and it doesn't make it right. But at the same time, like, I don't need to live in that anymore. Like, I don't need to live in that anger or that resentment. I forgive them, and I can even wish them the best. Like I hope that one day after this whole experience that we've had together, that maybe they'll have learned a lesson, and maybe the next time somebody comes out, they'll handle it better. I have to believe, and I like to believe that everything has a purpose, and even the painful things have meaning. I have that hope for the denomination and for that church, whatever it ends up being. I actually wish them well, and I hope that they do better next time.
Thank you for sharing that. Also for saying, I really appreciate you saying and not allowing your story to be limited to a single narrative. Because oftentimes as we're working through it, I can imagine how many of us can like maybe feel like we have to fit that box or that narrative that's been said. And I really appreciate you refusing your story to be limited to that. One of the things I'm sort of processing as I'm hearing your story is the relationship between art and shame. Mm-hmm. And so this question is for everyone, and I'm kind of formulating the question as I go, so bear with me. I've always associated art with grief or art with joy in terms of as we're working through those emotions and seasons. But I'm realizing that with shame, it's always been so cerebral for me. It's been like okay, the minute I notice shame in my body, I have this formula of how I want to, what I want, what I have to do in order to make sure it doesn't take hold of me too much, or it's at a point of it's too late. So it's always been very like cerebral and very like step one, step two for me. And now I'm realizing like, oh, I've never really connected of like, how can art play a role in working through my shame? And I'm curious what everyone's experience in terms of the relationship with art and shame is.
That's such a deep question. I love it.
It's so brilliant. One thing I want to say is, Tim, it's remarkable that you have the gift of songwriting to have a healthy outlet for your emotions. And I think that is definitely one of the values of both therapy and art, is finding language and expression for our emotions. So I'm an engineer by training from Virginia Tech, and then we have two other Virginians on this podcast today. And engineering is very left brain, so very concrete, tangible. But yet there was a whole emotional side of me that I didn't get to develop and find health in until my 40s and 50s. And one of the things that I learned along the way was art is the language of emotions. And I think that's how I connect all those dots together, that therapy and art and emotions and shame provide that space for us to be more human and find health for the emotions we all experience. But when we suppress them or push them down, as shame would prompt us to do, it festers and comes out sideways in unhealthy ways. So I'm grateful, Tim, that you're in a much better place. And your story, my hope is, helps people not to get trapped in ideologies and identity politics, but paves an example in a way that just as our fingerprints are all individual, each of us have an individual expression and journey in life to live out where we can flourish.
Yeah, and I think like art, like, you know, you talk about storytelling. I think that to me, that's what art is for me. Like art is storytelling. And, you know, it has a lot to do with, you know, there are things that happen to us, right? And they're just kind of like facts, right? Like they're just like, it's just like this, you know, A, B, and C happened, right? But like art is kind of narrative, right? It's like creating meaning around these things that happen to us, right? And that's such a powerful tool, right? Whether you're a writer, whether you're a painter or a musician, your art is a way of translating the things that happen into your life into something really beautiful, right? And so a lot of times when we have like shameful memories or traumatic memories, we can retell that story, you know, like we can actually reframe it. We can pivot and shift the perspective a little bit through our narrative, through our storytelling, and make it into something that is incredibly beautiful, right? And I think, you know, and I think that's why even throughout all of this, like I stayed a Christian, right? Because there's something about the Christian like narrative, this idea of taking broken things and restoring them and redeeming them and rebuilding them. There's something so beautiful and so compelling to me about that. And I feel like that's something that I've been trying to do my whole life, is just to take these like kind of broken and seemingly ugly things and dark things and reshaping them and remolding them. And so that when I look back on them, it's not this like sad, terrible story, but that it was part of something bigger, that it was part of this larger story that I get to tell now. You know, and Hannah, something that you were saying is like, yeah, when you're young, you don't have the advantage of being an adult to be able to look back and be able to like form kind of like this larger narrative. And luckily for me, I came out when I was 30. And I think a lot of young people don't have the advantage of doing that, right? Like they come out when they're younger, and then, you know, they, you know, have to contend with not only the natural fallout of something like that, but then they're also dealing with their hormones and a not fully developed frontal lobe, and, you know, and just all of these like these different factors that make it almost like impossible to deal with. And I think that's why art is so important, to help, especially young people, because they live in their emotions, right? Like, Leah, you were talking about like how shame is so cerebral for you, right? In a way, like that fully developed frontal lobe can kind of help quell some of your stuff that's like happening in your amygdala, right? But when you're a young person, like, you live in your emotions. And so you need almost like an emotional tool to help you process all of that stuff. Like, there, like, you could talk to somebody about the intellectual aspects of what they're feeling till you're blue in the face. But until somebody feels it, until somebody experiences it viscerally in their soul, their spirit, and their mind, it's not going to sink in, right? I mean, so I used to work with a lot of people who were, you know, who used to be addicts. I was part of this like Christian rehab ministry. And the one thing that I noticed for the people that were able to stay out of or kind of like stay away from their addiction, they had this almost like profound emotional spiritual experience that they could go back to. Like, there was like this some sort of totem in their life, this benchmark, this kind of altar in their life, where they had this something that was inexplicable, something that like was transcendent for them. It wasn't something where they talked themselves out of it, right? Like, this is, because that never works really, but it was like they said they had an encounter with God, right? And how can someone quantify that, right? Like, how can you really explain something like that? And so for me, you know, as an Asian American Christian, I think so much of Christianity has become so cerebral, you know, like where, you know, you're just like, okay, you believe this set of doctrines, you believe this particular theology, you recite it, and then, you know, and then now you're saved, right? Like, or it's often preached like, if you don't believe this, then you're going to hell, right? And so then instead of like a true belief, you know, in God, there's this almost like, let me just do this because I don't want to go to hell, right? And that's a very different thing. And so, you know, something that especially is very prevalent, I think, in kind of Asian American churches is this idea of behavior modification, you know, to kind of appear like a Christian. And this is prevalent, I think, in many different church cultures. But I think especially for Asian Americans, a lot of times, because our shame and honor culture is so intertwined with everything, there is this kind of fake it until you make it type of thing. Like, show people that you're a Christian by, like, you know, saying the right things and doing these certain things that, you know, that we would, you know, prescribe to you as being Christian. But what I've realized is that Christianity and fundamentally the gospel is not about behavior modification. It's about soul transformation. And that's something that's less quantifiable. Like, you can't distill what that is, right? Like, you can kind of sense it, right? Like, it's something that you can feel, but it's not something that you can kind of like, oh, like, they believe A, B, and C. I mean, like, we all, I think everybody here on this panel has encountered a Christian that said all the right things, but just seemed like a terrible human being. I mean, we've all come across that type of person before, right? So there's certainly something like beyond just like reciting, you know, the correct mantras, right? That goes into someone who's a Christian. There's like this actual transformation of spirit, a transformation of their entire being. And so that's something that relates to me back to art, which is like, if you can hit somebody in like the deepest parts of their spirit and their soul, if you can reach them there, you'll be much more successful at kind of like creating a transformation, right? And this is why, like, I think oftentimes, like, ideologies don't really work, you know, in art. For example, like, you know, we've all seen this before where someone like writes a song or puts out a song that's very ideological, that basically is spouting kind of the, the soup du jour of culture at the moment, you know, like, and, you know, people are kind of like, oh yeah, we're super excited about it, but it definitely doesn't move you. You know what I'm saying? Like it's something like, it just feels very like disconnected, right? There's like something almost like, again, like this, it's like very cerebral, right? Like, it's like, this is what you're supposed to think. This is what you're supposed to feel. But then sometimes there's these like art, there's art that comes along, right? That kind of like peels back a lot of that surface nonsense, right? And then like just hit somebody at their soul, at their core. And then they're just like, oh my gosh, I don't know why, but like, I'm weeping right now, or I'm just like, there's just something that is like so poignant about this that I can't explain. And so that's why I think art is one of those things that transcends, you know, ideology. It transcends kind of the, even like some of these like religious rules that we have in place. It helps break past all of that and hits people in their soul.
Tim, I want you to like write a book about that. Yeah, you say you haven't been to therapy, but I feel like I'm talking to like a worship pastor who's also like a counseling professor. I love it. I love it. As I'm listening and then thinking about Leah's question, I feel like the art that hits us the deepest, it's because there was suffering involved in the process of creating it. And when we look at, you know, art and shame and pain go together in my head. And people often try to numb that pain and run away from that shame. So there's a lot of staying in the dark and a lack of movement. So there's no process happening. And with my clients, we talk about how trauma is literally like frozen memories, right? Mm. Like your body and your brain, that your neurons were firing a certain way. Your body was clenched up in a certain way in unsafety. And your body and brain remember that. And it's stored in the unconscious. Mm. But the process of producing art for a lot of people is actually like intentionally turning towards that pain. Yeah. And looking, you know, very directly at the trauma and being able to say, this is, you know, worth engaging. I'm going to sit with the pain. I'm going to sit with the grief and everything that comes up. And I'm going to let that shame almost like surface. And I say, you let it surface and then wash out of you, right? Mm-hmm. It needs to be purged. But you have to engage it, you know, and we have to engage what's happening in the subconscious that's frozen in your brain and body. And it requires movement and engagement and turning towards, you know. So that's where I see kind of art is almost like the path, you know. It's a way of your subconscious being able to communicate and express and process what was held there and then have this narrative. And what often happens also with shame and trauma and pain is that there's these really hurtful messages that are stored in there, like these false beliefs. And Tim, your Inheritance Mag article, The Dark Voice, I mean, just a perfect just explanation of how those deep, dark messages get stored in trauma and traumatic memories. And, you know, part of writing or part of producing music and even expressive arts and dance, it's all about looking at those messages and saying, are these true? Or were these really false beliefs that I don't need to hold on to that were killing me and sucking the life out of me? And then how can I transform them? And then what comes out of that, you know, and is distilled from that is usually poignant, beautiful works of art, but they're beautiful not because they're perfect. They're beautiful because there's been this process of working out the pain. And it reminds me of wabi-sabi. I'm not going to describe it well, but the Japanese, there's like this concept of taking the cracks and then covering them in gold. And you have something more beautiful than that original, perfect, uncracked piece. Mm. Yeah, it was such a good question. Such a good question.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I took a lot of notes with all of you said.
So, you know, one thing that I'd love to hear is, you know, I'm always every Pride Month, I've been wondering, like, how do I witness and how do I put out my voice? Because I know that there's certain people and very much a wide spectrum of people that listen, you know, and I've always been a little careful because I have a lot of conservative people in my community whom I love, and they've been very honest and transparent with me that they're uncomfortable with things I do and say, and very confused by me. Because I've been a youth pastor and a children's pastor in an immigrant church context, and a Korean immigrant church. And some people have just written me off because they're like, oh, she's gone off to the deep end, the left side, right. The dark side. And so today I just kind of put out a post, in excitement, anticipation of today's episode. And it was recently my dad's, birthday. He passed 10 years ago. But I've just been processing this whole, like, I really want to not hide anything anymore, especially as a mom, for my child's sake, I really want to come to peace and integration with all the things that God's led me to become, even as I'm still becoming. So I did this post, actually, Tim, sharing your Dark Voice Inheritance Mag article and just talking about my own journey of coming out as an ally and somebody who wants to grow in allyship and anti-racism, and how this is all like a package deal for me. It's not like one thing at a time. It's just like, who is God calling me to be, and where can I join Jesus? For DJ and Leah and Tim, your community too. What is it like to kind of think about this concept of allyship and learning to come alongside or struggling with coming alongside our queer brothers and sisters? Because I feel like I had to come out as an ally because I knew that there'd be people who'd really struggle with that. But I finally come to a place where I'm like, that's your struggle. I don't have to be responsible for your struggle and feelings. Your relationship with God is yours, and my relationship with God is mine. And we can love one another and be honest with one another along the way.
Yeah. It's really interesting, like, this use of the word ally. Mm-hmm. In one sense, I think it is like, it is a useful word, but like many kind of like terminologies and phrases in our culture, I think it also has become very trite. It's also become very like, it's starting to lose its meaning in a way, because like now everybody is an ally in a way, we kind of have these very loose definitions of what is an ally, what's not an ally. And depending on who you talk to, they would say that, oh, an ally is this or an ally is that. I'll tell you what, I think that the people in my life who have had the most profound impact on my life and who have loved me the best and loved me well don't use that term ally. And I'm not saying it's a bad term, but I think in a way it kind of creates this weird boundary, right? Where it's just like, okay, you're the one who is this kind of othered, different person. So I'm just going to kind of like come alongside you now. And I think also, even the term ally, like you, when you're fighting a war, right, you kind of have allies, right? But they're not really your countrymen, right? Like, they just kind of come alongside you. They're kind of like fighting alongside you. But at the end of the day, once that war is over, they're gone, right? And so what I don't really want allies. I want countrymen, I want like people that are integrated into my life, that are not just allies walking beside me, but that are living my life with me. And I think there isn't really a word for that, right? Like, even the word friendship, I think, is kind of been diluted in our culture. But I think part of the reason why I've experienced so much depth and so much happiness in my life is that when I talk about being gay, especially on like podcasts and stuff, like I'm talking about it in a very particular lens, right? And I think even with this podcast right now, there's a particular intention. Like, we're talking about Pride Month, and so there's a particular focus, which is completely understandable, right? But I think what I share in this is a very small fraction of my life, right? Like, a lot of my friends, like, sometimes, like, there is I go to a very conservative church right now, ironically, and there's a pastor there and his wife who were very, very conservative when I first met, but they also had a lot of compassion for me, because they knew my story and they knew where I'd come from. And then over the last 2 years, as we've just become friends and, like, gotten to know each other, I rarely talk to them about gay. I really debate them about gay issues, right? I just kind of like tell them what's going on in my life. And then recently they were just like, we're not sure if we're like conservative anymore. We're not sure if we're not affirming anymore. We're kind of like just questioning now. And they were just like, it's just simply because we've gotten to know you and because you are our friend. And in a way it's like, it's not allyship at that point. It's just like, we love you so much that being in that, in your presence, there's something transformative happening in our lives and we can't quantify it, but we know it's real. And so, you know, I feel like it's very, you know, belief systems are really interesting because I think like they kind of like live up, you know, in the brain, but, and it's really easy to change someone's mind, but it's very difficult to change their heart, right? And we make most of our decisions kind of in here, not really up here. And so if you can tap into like a relationship that is much more of the heart and of the soul and this kind of intangible connection that I think so many people are hungry for right now. I think everybody in kind of 2021, we all have an excess of allies and not enough like real community and friends and like a tribe that we can call our own. Because we've kind of divided ourselves across ideological lines, right? And so what I describe like modern culture now, especially for the younger generations, if you've ever like raised kids before, you know, there's a time period in children's lives where they play side by side with each other, but they don't play with each other, right? So they have this common interest in like maybe the same toy or the same activity, but there's no actual connection with one another. So I don't know what the terminology is for that, but it's like
Parallel play,
right? So there's a lot of parallel play happening right now in our society where people are just like, oh, you believe what I believe, so I guess we're all aligned, so we'll just kind of be in this place together. Some of the most lonely people that I have met in these last few years have been political activists on both sides. Now, I'm not saying like as progressives or conservatives, I'm saying just political activists on both sides who are in a way obsessed with this idea of like ideological purity, or like, you know, if you don't believe what I believe, then we have nothing in common. I tend to take the approach of like, this is going to sound super arrogant. I take this approach of like, no one is going to be as amazing as me. So I just have to accept people as they are. And the reason I say that is, it's because everyone's kind of thinking it to a certain degree, right? It's just like, why don't you believe what I believe? Like, why aren't you saying the things that I want you to say? And for me, I'm just kind of like, of course you're not going to believe what I believe or think what I think, because you're not me and you haven't lived my life. And so how can I expect you to be fully educated and fully grasp like the pain and the things that I've gone through, and vice versa? Like, how can I fully understand what your life is having not lived it, right? And so, you know, there's this Bible passage that says like the measure which you use to judge others will be used against you. And so there's a really, I'm going to tell this really funny story. It's kind of like one of the most, it's a very funny story, but it's also kind of one of the most life-changing experiences that I've ever had in my life. So there was one time, me and my church friends were mostly Asian American. We were out eating. And then one of our friends brought their cousin. And she's like a white girl. And so she was, you know, introducing us, you know, all to one another. And then so I went up to shake her hand. I shook her hand and she was like, and she gave me that limp handshake, like this kind of like very non-committal, like, oh, here, you know, like, and I was in my mid-20s at this point. So I wasn't like, I still kind of was not fully developed in some ways. I just lost it. So like I went back to the table. Like she went to go grab some food or something, and I was talking to my friends at the table and I was just like, can you believe this white girl giving me like that limp handshake? Like I'm like nobody to her. Like how dare she do something I just lost it. It was kind of like this moment of psychosis where I had internalized this idea of like, oh, all white people, you know, are condescending and they look down on people like me. And like my friends at the table were all looking at me like, have you lost your mind? I was just spouting off all of this, like, this white girl, you know, does she know who I am? Like, you know, why does she think that she can treat me like this? So she comes back to the table. I'm actually super embarrassed to even share this story. She comes back to the table and my friend, she's just like, she looks at the girl and she's like, hey, can you just tell us like, why did you move to the Bay Area? Like, why are you here? And she was like, oh, yeah, well, so I used to be a nurse and, you know, I really loved my job, but then I developed hand cancer. And she was just like, and so because my hand got ruined by the cancer, she was like, I lost my job. And so I had to quit nursing. And so she was like, I moved recently to the Bay Area because I'm now volunteering with like this organization, you know, this like medical organization, yada, yada, yada. I was sitting there and like my friends all were just like side eyeing me and like just like trying to not laugh because I had just seconds ago just ripped this girl apart about how she was just like this condescending white girl, you know, who like, you know, just saw Asians as beneath her. And then she's sharing about how she had hand cancer, literally had hand cancer. And that's why she couldn't grip my hand. And I was just like, it was so embarrassing and so funny at the same time, because like my friends were just looking at me, just like, just trying not to laugh. And it was one of the most humiliating and embarrassing experiences of my life, but also one of the funniest and in a way, one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, because I experienced in real time instant feedback about how my racism and even my judgment and stereotypes of people had basically made me assume all of these things about somebody that weren't even true. You know, I just had assigned this kind of evil to somebody and they weren't evil. They were actually an incredibly good person who had actually been through an incredible amount of pain and suffering in their life. And so from that moment on, I told my friends, I was like, that was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. I will never, ever judge somebody based on their appearance ever again, you know? And it's been so valuable for me in my life because it's opened me up to like all these different friendships. And, you know, kind of like I was telling you before, like even before this podcast started, like, you know, I lived with a friend of mine who was a cop for a couple months, you know, during 2020, which was a very strange experience. And I, you know, I've had all of these like different friendships, like with people who are really conservative and people who are really progressive. And it's made my life so rich because like I have all of these people who see the world and interact with the world so differently. And I learn so much from all of them. Right. And I think sometimes, you know, people are experts on things that they know very little about. Right. And I think once you know something really well, you realize that you're not an expert. So for example, right, like I think that I'm a pretty good cook. So I'm always telling people like, oh, you should do this or you should do that. I have no idea what I'm doing. Like I can maybe make like a couple of dishes and it's like fine, it's edible, you know, but as a musician, I'm probably a lot more accomplished. Like I know like what I'm doing. But because I know what I'm doing, I know how complex it is and I know how much it actually takes to be a real expert in that field. So I would never label myself as an expert or a super proficient musician because there are very few people that I think deserve that honor, you know, or deserve that distinguishment. So, you know, in a way, like I've realized these things that I often prejudge people for, like, I have no idea. Like you don't know what you don't know. So I don't know. That's kind of why, like, I am very careful, and You know, you're talking, I totally didn't answer your question. You're talking about like allyship, but I think it's, I think as a queer person, I think what we want the most is just love, you know, love without kind of these like conditions or, you know, I don't want to be loved because someone feels sorry for me, you know, or because somebody, thinks that I need their allyship, you know, so to speak, because of I'm oppressed. Like, I just want friends. Like, I just want people that will love me for me, not just for my identity or my sexuality, but because they enjoy spending time with me, because they like talking to me. And that's the thing that I think a lot of, one thing that I read an article recently about how the gay community is actually one of the loneliest communities, even those that, you know, have these like, you know, that, you know, are even though like, I think homosexuality for the most part is a lot more widely accepted in our culture, there's still this kind of loneliness that people feel. And I think it's still this idea that like so many of us are defined by our sexuality. And I'm just like, there's so much more to me. Like, I'm just like, I think I'm really fun to be around, like all sexuality, like my sexuality aside, like I think I'm fun to talk to. I think that I love my friends really well. And so I think that's what, I would be looking for in somebody who wants to be an ally, to maybe shed some of that ally identity and just be like a real friend, like just be my friend, you know? So I don't know. That's kind of, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, Tim, you are fun to talk to. And it felt like you just kicked into a whole intellectual philosophical gear on beyond the songwriting and the storytelling, and that would be lovely to explore. And I think you put your finger right at the heart of the matter, is that our best gift is to love one another, mm-hmm. not just celebrate a month, not just mm-hmm. be on the right side of the issue. And I'm so grateful that you have found a place of belonging where you are loved, and you do have real friends, and you're not alone for that journey. And if we can show people that even though they may feel alone because of their whatever quirkiness they might have, there are people that care for them. And it may take some time and effort to find them, but the world's big enough that there are people that will care for them. Mm. And if we can care for people through Zoom, we would like to do that, but I know there's much more to life that has to be done in person. Good point to wrap up on. Thank you, Tim, for being with us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for sharing an embarrassing story. That makes us all more human.
Incredible.
Leah, closing thought, and Hannah?
Tim, I just actually want to also thank you so much. Your conversation, your story is like really helping me reframe and rethink a lot of, just a lot of things. And I'm an internal processor, so it's going to take me like a day or two to like formulate that into words. But thank you. Hearing your story feels like an honor, because in so many ways, it is the love story you're writing for yourself and the love story you're writing to the world around you. Mm. And it makes sense to me why so many people, especially queer kids, are being moved by your story and your art. So thank you for showing up in your art and to yourself so authentically. It is just an honor to hear that and witness that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for saying yes, for being with us and just showing up fully, like Leah said. I highly recommend y'all out there check out Tim Bietold's music. It's been soul touching for me. And like you shared in your article, really seen me through dark times, and so many people feel the same way. I'm proud to know who you are, and proud to be in this space together. I'm going to be chewing on that concept of being a countryman, woman, person, and friend, and somebody who loves. Thank you for that. It's a lot to chew on today. I'm going to have to watch this recording a couple times. Thank you. But Tim, I hope someday you write a children's book or series. And, you're an amazing writer, not just a songwriter, but writer. I think your story is something that's just so anointed, your life and your being. And, you're like my personal worship pastor.
That's so sweet.
I meet with God, I meet with God, and he speaks through your music to me, and has been for years. So thank you. I don't know if you're ever going to put out a gospel album or, more of that kind of we could play in church music. But I would love that. I look forward to what you will continue to produce as you journey along and who you are.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, actually, of gospel, I don't know if you guys saw that I released a song recently with an organization called Beloved Arise, and it's called Watching Over You. Beloved Arise actually put together this compilation album, and it's basically dedicated to queer youth of faith. So it's basically Christian songs that are meant to encourage, kids who've always felt like the songs about God were never for them. And so these are it's like a compilation of different artists. And I wrote a song for that album, and it's called Watching Over You. So if you're interested, check it out. It's a song that, in a way, that I wrote to my childhood self, that I, what I imagined God was telling me when I was younger. So, and there's a gospel choir on it, which is pretty dope. So
nice. So it's on the album Serenade or Serenade?
Serenade, yeah.
Serenade. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, I see it. Third track, Watching Over You. Check it out, people. Tim B. Told on Facebook, on iTunes, Spotify.
Yes, we'll add a link in the show notes at erasingshame.com. Thank you so much, Tim L. Yang, for being with us and sharing so much of your life with the world. You are truly a gift. Thank you. And thank you, listeners and viewers, for being with us in this episode of Erasing Shame. Subscribe and like us on Facebook, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. Your review and rating would be most appreciated. We'll see you next month. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Erasing Shame podcast. Check out our website at erasingshame.com. We would love to hear your comments and questions. Please subscribe on any podcast app like Apple, Google, Spotify, or on Facebook and YouTube. And please add a rating, a review, and a share so more people can experience the freedom and healing that comes from erasing shame.